This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hello, and welcome to Digital Nomads, a podcast about nomadism and nomadic peoples around the world and throughout history. I'm your host, Maggie, and today I am honored to be speaking with Dr. Salah Hatem and Jafar Jodhri about their project, which is called Creating an Intangible Cultural Heritage Teaching Module for Iraq's National Undergraduate University Curriculum, Bedouins of the Iraqi Southern Desert as a Case Study. And this project is sponsored by the Nahrain Network at University College London, of which Dr. Jodhri is a co-director. The Nahrain Network has as its mission to foster the sustainable development of antiquity, cultural heritage, and the humanities in Iraq and neighboring countries. Doctors Hatem and Jodhri are both assistant professors in archaeology at the University of Al-Qadisiyah in Iraq. And today I'm really excited to learn more about and to share with you some of the work that's been done so far on this project, which involves documenting and preserving the intangible cultural heritage of the Bedouin in southern Iraq, as well as developing a teaching module on intangible cultural heritage for use in Iraq's university curriculum. So thank you, Dr. Hatem and Dr. Jodhri, for joining me today.
You're welcome.
So could you start by providing some context about the Bedouin of southern Iraq, who you're working with for this project, and what are the aspects of their cultural heritage that you're seeking to document and to preserve through this project?
You know, we have in Iraq, the term Bedouins in Iraq referring to two things. The Bedou that dealing with or using camels, and the Bedou that use sheep. So two things, both of them actually, they live in desert. So when we start, they live in, you know, from the north of Iraq, middle of Iraq, and south of Iraq. We have this project, and we should decide which type of Bedou we are going to study and in which area. We cannot study whole of Iraq. We cannot study whole of types of Bedouins. So then we met and discussed the issue, and we decided that we should study the western part of Iraq, the southwestern part of Iraq, which cover three main provinces, Najaf, Samawa, and Basra, and of course, Nasiriyah. So four provinces, they contain the two types of Bedouins. The Bedou that using camels and the Bedou that using sheep. And we decided that we study the Bedou that they don't have a house in the cities or villages. So totally nomadic people, traveler, they don't have any home or house in the villages or, you know, cities. So let's say Bedouin 24/7. But of course, they stay in the desert in a specific season, and back to the, let's say, floodplain where Tigris and Euphrates there, in a specific period of time within the year. But generally, they don't have a house in the floodplain. They only use nets and other things. So this is the main idea of the project. Why we selected Bedouin? Because, you know, we don't have any idea as scholars, as a public, as students, of course. We don't have any idea about that. And of course, it is intangible heritage. We're always focusing on archaeological side, the tangible heritage, but nobody cares about the intangible heritage. That's why the project is really important, and Nahal Network funded it, and we have an amazing team started to work on it. Salah and his team actually divided the area into four teams. Each province has a team. So Najaf, Samawa, Nasriya, and Basra. When I say these provinces, I mean the desert part of this provinces, not the floodplain part. Because, you know, Najaf has the desert and the floodplain. Samawa has desert and floodplain. And Nasriya and Basra. So the team started 2 months ago. They went to the desert and met the Bedouins, and they have a list of questionnaire. And of course, when they went there, they took with them like a gift, and they dressed or wear clothes to the same, the Bedouins, kufiya and covering head, and, you know, yeah, similar the Bedouins. Of course, they started to introduce themselves to the Bedouins. And of course, we have our task is to interview not only the men. We should interview children, women, tribe leaders, different categories of Bedouins. So let's say 20% of our interviews with women, 20% with children, 40% with tribe leaders, and the rest with the other types of Bedouins. And we started the interviews, and each 2 weeks we sit and then discuss or debriefing interviews. And we conclude that, you know, some point that Salah will talk about. So the first point is that the Bedouin actually, they put themselves away from the governments, and the governments actually put themselves away from them. So there is no connection between the Bedouins and the government. They don't have any representative in the parliament. They don't have a public figure that can speak to the any type of a government. So that's why they've been neglected from all the governments that led Iraq. Nobody cares about them, and nobody looked after them. We don't have statistical information about them, how many they are, how do they feel, are they okay? And, you know, lots of political issues raised during the last 30 years. We have, you know, there is no border. There was no border between Iraq and Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Jordan. So they used to, you know, travel from Iraq to the other to neighboring countries, and always the Iraqi's government punished them actually for traveling, for breaking the law. But in the same time, the Iraqi government doesn't offer something. So it's just punishing, not offering things. So so that's why they feel themselves as a target of the government. When we go there, they afraid of us. They think we will prosecute them, or we know their wrongdoing, because they think that their activities is against the law. they feel that the Iraqi government made them feeling that they are outlaws or something like that. So the first conclusion is that there is no relationship between, or there is a bad relationship between them and the Iraqi government. Yeah.
For the second result that they found, just to give a little bit of, you know, background about the Bedouins in Iraq, which Jafar had mentioned right before, the Bedouins in Iraq seemed almost like an outcast. They are very forgotten within society. And so there is this disconnect between, you know, the Bedouins. There's not a lot of research done. And so this project is really important because they're looking at this, you know, very important, you know, part of Iraqi heritage, and learning about them more because, you know, the government hasn't been involved and there hasn't been any studies. And that's what, you know, the Dr. Salah's team has found within their studies. So they are very forgotten. But what they realized also is that these people who've lived in the desert have learned to cope within very extreme heat. So he's talking about how it extends, they extend between, we'd say like West Ramadi to the borders with Saudi Arabia and Kuwait almost. And, you know, if you look at a map, that's mostly desert. So they've learned how to, through inherited knowledge from their ancestors and whatnot, they've learned how to, you know, find water. So there's special plants that they use, which is called akul. I don't know how to really translate it to English, but also cacti to find water. And also they've learned, like, they've inherited a lot of medicinal, traditional medicine. And that's how, you know, they treat, you know, themselves. So they're very, just like how we don't know much about them, they're really afraid of also interacting. And that's one of the findings he's found, is that the children were very afraid of them when they went there.
To what you just said, it sounds like there's this issue of the distrust between the Bedouin and sort of the external society. So I'm wondering what your strategies are for overcoming that lack of trust that the Bedouin might feel towards you as these sort of external researchers who are attempting to kind of study them, but what those strategies that you've developed are for being able to gain information from the Bedouin. And then you also mentioned the questionnaires and the series of questions that you ask Bedouin. And I was wondering if you could give some examples of specifically what those questions are and what specific types of information you're soliciting from them.
No, I'm just going to answer the second question, which was the questionnaire, since I have a list here of basically what they were. And then Dr. Salah could elaborate more. But they were looking at, you know, a lot of their inherited culture. So their dialect, their accent, how they look at beauty and, you know, how they celebrate, for instance, weddings, or how they grieve also when they have, you know, someone who passes away. They looked at their, you know, gatherings, how they teach their children, if they do go to any public schools, you know, the role of young women and the role of elderly women as well. Again, they also looked at, you know, the different types of medicine that they've inherited, so traditional medicine. Yeah, so, and just, you know, their general day-to-day life. So that was the questions they were looking at.
In terms of our strategy to extract the information or the knowledge from the Bedouins, we have a list to follow before we go to the desert. Wearing like them, dress like them, I mean, speak like them. And of course, we should have a guide, a friend, a mutual friend between us and them. So when we go them, they at least know one of them, know very well. So it should be driver or someone else. So he took to them and introduced us to them. So they feel comfortable. And then we start ask them. they of course speak with us freely because they trust the person who accompany us. And it worked very well, because otherwise they will not answer our question. Sometimes they answer just a general question, not a specific one. So this is the first strategy. In terms of our goal, at the end of the project, we will write to the Iraqi parliament to make, you know, the quota, because there is a quota for the women, for the Iraqi minorities, and we would like to suggest that the Bedouin should have a quota. And then we should select a representative from the real Bedouins who lives already in the desert to come to the, to be a member of the Iraqi parliament to speak of the Bedouins. And of course, we should teach our students how to respect the Bedouins, respect their accent, their fashion, their dress, their everyday life. We should not make a joke. We should not insult them. They are a real part of Iraq. They are the indigenous people of Iraq. Each tribe of Iraq, you know, has a Bedouin. For example, my tribe, we share the Jodhari, for example. There's a Jodhari Bedouin, and there's a Jodhari living in the city. So they are part of us, part of our community. And they are suffer, you know, they are not enjoying their life. They are facing the climate change, facing the harsh weather, facing the harsh environment. They just need to survive. They are, you know, safe people. They are lovely people. We should take care of them. We have the resources. They don't have access to the public money. We do. We should convince them that they should believe in the state, in the border. In their mentality, they think there is no border of the desert. The desert is open. There is no border. But we put the border. We punish them when they cross the border. We don't offer any service to them. No clean water, no paved roads, no school for their children, no hospital when they get sick. So they live in the medieval period. And why we should feel responsible to them. So we will speak about that in a workshop and in our curriculum with the decision maker, with the stakeholders. So it's a big responsibility for us, actually. Of course, we are enjoying doing the research, but it's give us a responsibility. For me, I don't know before about their everyday life. I'm now surprised. It's a long answer, I think.
No, that was great.
Good. Okay, Dr. Salah, should we move to another point with Dr. Salah, or do you have a following up question?
No, go ahead.
Okay.
In terms of the tents, because they do live in tents, and you know, before, a lot of these tents were actually handmade, and it was inherited from their grandparents and parents. So this was a skill that they actually had. But even this has now been forgotten. So they don't, unfortunately, they don't do these by hand, and they import them from Syria. I guess it's probably cheaper and just more efficient for them. But before, they used to do them all by hand, and they don't anymore. So that's a skill that's kind of gone from their heritage. It's probably lost. Their children won't know how to do it either. The Bedouin society is very patriarchal. So there is usually the head of the tribe, where he's called the Sheikh al-Ashira. And but however, over the past few years, it has changed. They used to live in big groups, but now they don't. The Sheikh al-Ashira, which is, you know, the head of the tribe, actually would live probably closer to the city. However, they also realize that women in the tribes play a very important role. And economically, they are responsible for a lot of, you know, like, for instance, they are the camel drivers So we are speaking here not of the shepherds, but more of the camel drivers, Bedouins. So they are responsible for, you know, taking care of the camels, raising the children, and or even organizing the family, for instance, like marriages and what have you. So, but again, you know, it has changed significantly how they live over the past few years. So you don't move around as much. Whereas if you look at Bedouins from, you know, the Gulf area, they tend to move a lot. But the ones in Iraq, that has kind of stopped. So another very important factor here that's been affecting their lives is that they've realized there's been a great, their land has kind of been narrowing because of agriculture development. So a lot of these lands have been taken to, you know, expand on just, you know, farming, but not just that. They've also been taking land for brick factories. And so you find that their way of life is almost going to be extinct because they can't take care of their camels as they were able to before. Their camels don't have, you know, the plants that they need to feed them or the water. And so this thing is almost imminent, or it's probably happening within the next few years. They're just running out of space. So their relationship in specific, we're talking about, you know, the camel driver Bedouins, they have a very strong relationship, you know, with their camels. And he just ended with a saying that they say in their dialect, where that, you know, the camel knows everything, just doesn't have a tongue. And so because of this loss of land and they can't move around as easily as they did, they're having to sell some of their camels in order to buy more food for the other camels, which is not a viable solution, as he was explaining to Dr. Salah. They're losing a lot of, you know, their camels, which they find, which they have it's really important to them. This lifestyle for them is more important than anything else. And that's why they want to preserve that as much as they can, even if it means they have to sell some of their, you know, camels to just keep that. So they could keep that and keep living that way. So just a few quick notes here. Basically, they couldn't find, you know, the younger Bedouins didn't have a lot of knowledge of art, poetry, literature. Mostly it was the elders who have that passion. And unfortunately, they couldn't get any interviews with them. Again, because they do have that fear of outsiders. So even, like I said, the children were very, you know, reserved and just stayed away. Another point he makes is marriage is always usually within their tribe. So they don't prefer to marry, you know, their women or men from people from the city, as they won't be able to live that lifestyle, that nomadic lifestyle of moving around.
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
The Bedouin families have grown, and the ones who are a little bit more wealthy, especially those related to the head of the tribe, have now split their life in between, you know, the city and the desert. So they're able to have these two lives where they are able to have a house and live in the city, have a phone, and, you know, send their kids to school, while having, because they can't afford it, they can have shepherds, you know, in the desert taking care of, you know, their goats and their lands over there. And these families, usually a typical Bedouin family is made up of between 10 to 15 people. Because they have to, you know, kind of move with, you know, all these changes that are happening, the wealthier ones can, you know, afford to live in the city while keeping their lifestyle, while still going back whenever they need to, especially if there's occasions or weddings or a death in the family, they will have that type of life.
Shukran, shukran, Doctora. Okay, I think this is what we have for now, because, you know, we are just in the first 2 months in our work, and we are happy for any question, Maggie.
Yeah, thank you so much. This is extremely fascinating. Your suggestion or goals, I guess, for this project of achieving political representation for the Bedouin is not necessarily what I would have expected from a project on cultural heritage. So I'm curious if you can say a little bit more about that, about how you see those two things coming together, how you think cultural heritage and the documentation of and preservation of the Bedouins' cultural heritage can in turn provide them with some political agency.
Yeah, we are not politicians. The Nahra Network is not funding a political project, but we are dealing with the Iraqi living heritage. So bringing the past and putting and knowing the future. You know, the Nahra Network is how to use heritage to build your society, how to use heritage to thrive your community. Heritage is a tool. So we are using heritage to value the Bedouin. And as a result, one of the value of the Bedouin is representative. So it's just a start. The project is just a start. The project will help Iraqis, different stakeholders, to understand the Bedouin. Once everybody understood the Bedouins, then we think about how to serve them better. So this idea jumped in my mind to call about a representative. It's like a side effect of the project. We have lots of projects ongoing here in Iraq. Yeah, for example, we are looking for a dictionary to document the Marsh Arab people. They have their own dialogue, or their own accent, and it's disappearing. Another team funded by Nahra Network working in the marshes of Iraq, documenting their unique accent or unique dialect. So you see, we are moving to the north of Iraq, where we are documenting the heritage building that affected by armed conflict. Moving to the east of Iraq, Iraq-Iran borders, we are documenting the heritage that affected by Iran-Iraq war. So you see, this is the Nahra Network. We are, you know, as we mentioned, British money funding Iraqi ideas. This is the Iraqi ideas, not the British ideas. We are just funding them. So you see, I mean, that's why Nahra Network is active. It's alive. It's funding, not the building. It's looking for the people as well. So one of our aim is to make the society or the community not great again. But I mean, you know, it's living heritage. So not dead heritage. Right. We are not dealing with the dead worldly building. So when we go to any city, we have like an ancient building, an ancient house. So we should go deep, doing interviews, digging in the history of this building, not the architecture of the building. So that's why this is the new way of research in Iraq. This type of research will benefit the Iraqi community, Iraqi scholar, Iraqi public. This type of research is needed for Iraq in this period of time after the long time of conflicts.
That leads me to my next question, which was about the education aspect of this project. And if I understood correctly, part of the goal is to develop a teaching module around the results from this project. And so I'm curious about the sort of plans and prospects for that, what that might actually look like. As you say, there's, you know, this is about intangible cultural heritage, which is something that's harder for us to conceptualize than things like brick and mortar architecture or art or something that we can look at with our two eyes. So I'm wondering about how you're planning to make this sort of intangible cultural heritage concrete in order to be able to teach it in universities, for example.
Yeah, thank you for this interesting question. You know, in Iraqi system, the archaeology department has 4 years of study, first, second, third, and fourth. Each year has two semesters. Each semester has 6 modules. So you see how many modules we have. So some of these modules actually are dealing with intangible heritage. But in general, not a single case study from Iraq. We are dealing with the song, fashion, kitchen tools, and you know, farming tools. All of these tools, actually, we are looking. This is intangible heritage. So we already teaching our students the intangible heritage of the area, not in Iraq in general. So that's why we decided to teach them the Iraqi intangible heritage, not in general. And we selected the Bedouin heritage because it's much needed, it's more neglected. And I think our student and of course our scholars will be happy and will find it as a really important module because it's really understandable. We don't need educated people to study it. We will make it easy and available to everyone. And we call it intangible heritage. Of course, this module will open the door to other intangible heritage to be studied. So our student and the scholar will think, okay, how about we study the farming, the farmers, also they do have tangible heritage. How about we study the other professionals and, you know, haraf al-yadawiyya, scarves, we call it. Anyway.
Great. Yeah.
Yeah, so we have maybe 10, 15 types of intangible heritage that need to be studied. So yeah, I think we will use. Of course, we will produce a book, maybe 200 pages, with let's say maybe hundreds of photos, link for videos. We're already taking hundreds of thousands of photos and videos to the Bedouins. So for me, I went to the desert and I saw the Bedouins there. Then I understood. I understand them. We would like to make a book so our students, they can understand the Bedouin where they are in the university. They don't need to go to the desert to see how the Bedouins looks like. Yeah.
I'm curious as to what you think the Bedouin want out of this project. I think, you know, you talked about sort of your aims, what you would like to be able to offer the Bedouin. And I'm curious if your, you know, your intentions coincide with what the Bedouin might hope to receive from this project? Or, yeah, do you have any sense of what they would want to see happen as a result of this?
Yeah, thank you. They don't care about our aid. We offered them, yeah, we will write your history. We will go to the government to ask for a representative. We will make everybody respect you. This is an important book to be taught in the universities. They don't care, actually. They care about they need service. They need clean water. They need hospital. They need their children to be sent to the school. So, you know, they need their everyday life. They have short need. They don't have a long-term plan. They don't know what's happened in the future. And they do have a short memory. They don't even can cite or mention their fourth grandfather. For me, actually, I can cite or mention my 20th grandfather. So easy for me. I can't stop it now. But for them, they don't. They don't remember their fourth grandfather, and they don't know what's happened in the future. So you see, they are short-minded because you know they live in a desert. They are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Afwan, Dr. Jafar,
sorry. Yeah, they are comparing themselves with the Gulf States Bedouins. The Gulf State Bedouins, they live in privilege. They have a 4x4 car. Their government are looking after them. There is a food for them and for their animals. The regulations are standing with the Bedouin, not against them. The Bedouins are welcome in the cities and villages in the Arab Gulf states. So they always they are look they wanted to be like to be treated by the Iraq government similar to what the Arabian Gulf states treating their Bedouins. So they are jealous, they are blaming us, they are always shouting, why?
Could I maybe ask a follow-up question to that? So just to clarify, is the reason for maybe the Bedouin in the Gulf states receiving more resources than the Bedouin in Iraq because the Gulf states have more resources to give simply, or is there also a cultural difference between how those states respectively value the Bedouin?
Very important question. I think because the majority of Iraq came from villages, farmers, cities background, so they think that they are everything. They are ignoring the Bedouins. The Bedouins is less than 0.5% from Iraq population. And there is no connection between the Iraqis, they are living in the floodplain, villages, towns, cities, and the Bedouin. This is the case in Iraq. But in the Arab Gulf states, you cannot recognize between the everyday life of the cities people, let's say, or the Bedouins. The same accent, the same tradition, the same dress. They are different just even they, you know, they are using the same cars maybe. They do have houses. So why? Because most of the population of the Arab states came from Bedouins. They don't have rivers. They don't have marshes. So we have in Iraq cities more than 5,000 years old. I live in Babylon. Babylon is more than 4,000 years old. It's a city since, you know, 4,000 years old. My memory is, I don't have any memory out of Babylon. So I was there maybe since 4,000 years old. But, you know, if we look at the Kuwait, Saudi, Bahrain, there was just a tribe of nomadic people. And then they became state, became cities and capitals. So they came from Bedouins, 100%, We in Iraq, we are already living in cities and farms. We do have little minority of Bedouins. So that's why I'm not justifying that, but that's why we are not caring more about the Bedouins.
So I just wanted to thank all three of you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. This was really interesting. I look forward to following your project and hopefully seeing and reading more about it. I'm looking forward to the book that we've been promised. And yes, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you, Zeynep, for the translation. Thank you, everyone. Yeah.
Thank you for listening, and of course, special thanks to Drs. Salah Hatem and Jafar Jodhari for sharing their work. Thanks also to Zeynep from the Nahrain Network, who provided assistance with translation during our conversation. I will post links to places where you can follow Dr. Hatem, Dr. Jodhari, and the Nahrain Network, and where you can learn more about their work and about this project as it evolves on my Twitter at nomads_pod. So please check that out if you're interested. You can also contact me there or by email at digitalnomadspod@gmail.com. If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, or if there's a topic that you'd like me to cover in the future. Thanks so much for listening.